Christ in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for Conversations of Consequence.
America is as divided as it has been in 150 years.
Politics is symptomatic of the culture.
They don't have a personal relationship with Christ.
We've been sacramentalized, but not evangelized.
Why should Washington listen to us when our own house is in disarray?
The church's greatest riches are her people.
Share the contagious joy of being a friend of Christ.
Story after story after story of people who have had inexplicable healings.
Broadcast from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
That's beautifully said, Al.
Thanks for your voice for liberty.
It's like a homecoming each time on your program.
Clear to me that you've thought these things through at a deep level.
Let's build the church, and then we'll bless the nations. And a good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta. I thank you for joining me. And, of course, on this Thanksgiving Day, we should do quite a bit about Thanksgiving. Because for Catholics in particular, the source and summit of our faith is the Eucharist. The Eucharist is what? The Thanksgiving, right? It is the sacrament by which we become partakers of the divine nature. It's the sacrament by which we see the offering of Christ in the invitation to salvation. So we're going to talk about Thanksgiving, always remembering that behind our acts of Thanksgiving lies the Thanksgiving we offer God for our creation, our preservation, all the blessings of this life, and above all for our redemption in Christ Jesus. Let me pick up a little story from Thanksgiving lore, which is historical. It has to do with Squanto. Squanto was the member of the tribe best known for being an early liaison between the native populations of southern New England and the Mayflower pilgrims. When the Mayflower landed in 1620, Squanto worked to broker a peaceful relations between the pilgrims and the local tribes. Played a key role, apparently, in the early meetings in March of 1621. He ended up able to speak broken English. He lived with the pilgrims for 20 months, was a translator, a guide, an advisor. He introduced the settlers to the fur trade, taught them how to sow and fertilize native crops, and then, you know, stayed with them quite a while. Eventually professed faith in Christ and was baptized. There's a lot of mythology that's grown up around Squanto. And there's a lot of historical work that's been doing. We just came across something by Neil Salisbury of Smith College in Massachusetts, an emeritus professor of history, and mentioned that Squanto, whose name was Tisquantum, I guess the real name, Tisquantum, was most likely baptized by Franciscans and then certainly baptized again by Anglicans. And the pilgrims did recognize Squanto as a Christian. The colonists referred to him as a Christian. They don't say whether he was attended their church or whether he was baptized. And Salisbury points out that, look, the historical sources aren't always very explicit. He's got a manuscript expected to be published next year in which he's going to trace Tisquantum's journeys, Squanto's journeys, back and forth across the Atlantic. Most scholars, he pointed out, fail to note that 20 years before the advent of Puritan missionaries, Tisquantum was New England's first Christian Indian. This is because the Franciscans actually got to him first. He was born in modern Plymouth, Massachusetts. He was born around 1585. Was captured in 1614 by one of English explorer John Smith's associates, Thomas Hunt. Hunt brought Tisquantum and some two dozen others of his tribe to Spain. He intended to sell them into the slave trade there. But Salisbury goes on to make the point that Catholic forces had seized that area of Spain in 1487 during the reconquest of Spain. And there some local friars, probably Franciscans, learned that the captives had been brought from a Christian land. So they spirited some of them away instructed them in the Christian faith, and Salisbury believes that Tisquantum was moved into an English trader's household and then attended Anglican services. So you can see the historical lines here are pretty tortured. But we're trying to reach Neil Salisbury to have him come on and lay out what is the best current research on the life of Squanto, one of those central figures in the American Thanksgiving story. Well, what I'd like to do next as we warm up for our Thanksgiving interviews today is go back to the Thanksgiving Proclamation of George Washington, 1789, October 3rd. I want to actually read it because I think it's important not just to talk about what some of these historical figures did, but it's also important to read what they wrote so we get a feel for how they presented themselves and what they were comfortable saying and sometimes what they weren't comfortable saying. But here it is. It's not that long. By the President of the United States of America, a proclamation. Whereas it is the duty of all nations to acknowledge the providence of Almighty God, to obey his will, to be grateful for his benefits, and humbly to implore his protection and favor. Just point out, notice, it is the duty of all nations to acknowledge the providence of Almighty God. This was not a controversial thought at the time. I should point that out. It was widely thought by leaders of all the Western nations that they had an obligation to rule by the providence of Almighty God. So, whereas it is the duty of all nations to acknowledge the providence of Almighty God, to obey his will, to be grateful for his benefits, and humbly to implore his protection, and whereas both houses of Congress have, by their joint committee, requested me to recommend to the people of the United States a day of public thanksgiving and prayer to be observed by acknowledging with grateful hearts the many signal favors of Almighty God, especially by affording them an opportunity peaceably to establish a form of government for their safety and happiness. Now, therefore, I do recommend and assign Thursday, the 26th day of November, next to be devoted by the people of these states to the service of that great and glorious being who is the beneficent author of all the good that was, that is, or that will be. That we may, then, all unite in rendering unto him our sincere and humble thanks for his kind care and protection of the people of this country previous to their becoming a nation, for the signal and manifold mercies and the favorable interpositions of his providence, which we experience in the course and conclusion of the late war, for the great degree of tranquility, union, and plenty which we have since enjoyed, for the peaceable and rational manner in which we have been enabled to establish constitutions of government for our safety and happiness, and particularly the national one now lately instituted, for the civil and religious liberty with which we are blessed, and the means we have of acquiring and diffusing useful knowledge, and in general, for all the great and various favors which he hath been pleased to confer upon us. And also, that we may then unite in most humbly offering our prayers and supplications to the great Lord and ruler of nations, and beseech him to pardon our national and other transgressions, to enable us all, whether in public or private stations, to perform our several and relative duties properly and punctually, to render our national government a blessing to all the people, by constantly being a government of wise, just, and constitutional laws, discreetly and faithfully executed and obeyed, to protect and guide all sovereigns and nations, especially such as have shown kindness unto us, and to bless them with good government, peace, and concord, to promote the knowledge and practice of true religion and virtue, and the increase of science among them and us, and generally, to grant unto all mankind such a degree of temporal prosperity as he alone knows to be best. Given under my hand at the city of New York, the 3rd day of October, in the year of our Lord, 1789, George Washington. So there you have it. It's quite a different tone and content than we expect from American presidents today. The directness of his confidence, right, about God's providence, God's judgment, and the necessity of giving thanks for particular things that the colonists had experienced, I think is a great demonstration of Washington's leadership, and I would say his personal faith. Now, people sometimes complain that he was not in any way an Orthodox Christian. He refused to take the Eucharist at the Anglican services. He was a vestryman in his Anglican congregation. But, you know, I don't have any anything, so he did. So take him for what he is. He may not be the most Orthodox Christian around, but he certainly was a man who believed in divine providence and in a final judgment and in God's governance and benevolence. So, and he made, it was enough to motivate him to lead the American people in such a prayer. So, I like to bring out again these moments in American history which remind us from whence we came. And this being Thanksgiving, I'd like to just take a look at how Thanksgiving actually functions in our spiritual life. Not exhaustively, but I want to make a particular point about anxiety and worry and how Thanksgiving is given to us by the writers of the New Testament as a way of dealing with anxiety and worry. And, you know, we all know we're living in a world in which many things seem random and out of our control. And anxiety is not something we wish for, but we end up feeling. How does Thanksgiving help us dealing with worry, dealing with anxiety? And I want to begin by just talking about what Jesus taught us in the Gospel of Matthew. In fact, I'll read at some length from Matthew chapter 6, verses 25 to 34. Jesus has just finished his statements. No one can serve two masters. He will hate the one and love the other. He will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and mammon, or God and money. Therefore, so that, you know, whenever there's a therefore, you have to find out what it's there for. And the therefore follows the Jesus' statement that, look, you can't have it both ways. You've got to make a choice. You're going to serve God or you're going to serve temporal prosperity. Therefore, having laid out for you your two choices, therefore I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or drink. In other words, he's trying to make it easy for us here. He's trying to say, don't make temporal provision, don't make money your God, because you don't need to worry, because God will provide. So let me read at length. Therefore, I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or drink, or about your body, what you will wear. Is not life more important than food, and the body more important than clothes? Look at the birds of the air. The modern translations often use the phrase, look at the birds of the air. I like the older translation. It's actually more, it keeps in mind the Greek of the passage better. Consider the birds of the air. In other words, ponder this. Don't just look, but think about it. Reflect on it. Consider the birds of the air. They do not sow or reap or store away in barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not much more valuable than they? And who of you, by worrying, can add a single hour to his life? And why do you worry about clothes? See how the lilies of the valley grow. They don't labor or spin, and yet I tell you that not even Solomon in all of his splendor was dressed like one of these. If that is how God clothes the grass of the field, which is here today and tomorrow is thrown into the fire, will he not much more clothe you, O you of little faith? So do not worry, saying, what shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or what shall we wear? For the pagans run after all these things, and your heavenly Father knows that you need them. So seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. Therefore, do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. So again, this is really an extension of what Jesus has taught that you cannot serve two masters. You cannot serve both God and mammon, God and money, God and temporal prosperity. And he gives us a reason for that. We don't have to go serving mammon or money or temporal prosperity because God will provide. And this is, in fact, the antidote for anxiety. You know, no one wants to be anxious. You don't get up in the morning and say, you know, I think I'm going to enjoy being anxious today. Anxiety, worry, is just not all that voluntary. There are things we can do to avoid anxiety, but telling someone not to be anxious is a little like telling a depressed person, you know, just to buck up and get happy. You just don't do it. It's not done that way. Now, somebody, you can choose not to eat a piece of chocolate cake, right? But to choose not to be anxious is of a different sort. We don't just say no to anxiety. We have to have strategies to avoid anxiety. And Jesus is pointing out that our anxiety and our worry comes from having the wrong fix on life. And he has a way of avoiding anxiety, and it comes back again to knowing God, knowing his love for us, knowing his provision for us. And so much of what we worry about are things that ultimately we can't control. You know, the one thing that psychologist Rollo May pointed out in his book on the meaning of anxiety, the one thing we can't control ultimately is death. It is the final no that God gives us to remind us that we don't control the universe. He does. And Jesus points this out too. Who of you can add a single day to your lifespan? So underneath all of our anxieties, the ultimate worry or anxiety is death. And Jesus has himself brought forth the very wonderful fact that death has been overcome, and he is victorious even in that final negation that we all must face. But Christians do not have to go through death like those who have no hope. We face the ultimate fear, the ultimate anxiety, the ultimate worry by uniting ourselves to the one who has already pioneered and walked us through that greatest negation, death itself. To me, that's a great reason to be thankful today, this Thanksgiving of 2019. I'm Al Cresta.
Father Benedict Groeschel.
I often go back to my childhood. In church, we love to be reverent, to Christ present in the Eucharist, to Christ on the cross. But I was also impressed by the reverence of my friends in the Salvation Army. They had a little band, and I used to walk past the band on Sunday morning on my way to church. And I was just a child, but I said, you know, they're trying to pray to God. They're showing reverence to God. All this was reverence. Now what do I see? I hear one irreverence after another. And week after week, month after month, the media churns out things that make fun of religion in general and make fun of Christianity in particular, and particularly make fun of the Catholic Church. No class. Absolutely no class.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
There is genuine consolation from the Catholic Catechism regarding the death of a loved one. The Christian who dies in Christ Jesus, we are told, is away from the body and at home with the Lord. Death marks the end of a Christian's sacramental life, but the fulfillment of his new birth, which began at baptism, now has a definitive conformity to the image of Jesus Christ. The Christian funeral does not give the deceased a sacrament or sacramentals because he or she has passed beyond the sacramental economy. The different funeral rites express the paschal character of Christian death. The greatest consolation to the Christian is the knowledge that even in death, we are separated only temporarily, that one day, if we have lived well, we will all be together again in Christ. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Christ is the answer, with Father John Ricardo.
In the midst of our culture today, in this age of relativism, which wants to grant Jesus some significance, but not so much, so we'll give him wise man, great leader, inspiring preacher, great teacher, prophet. You don't get that option when you claim to be God. What reasons do we have to believe that he is who he said he is? And it's important, again, to employ the use of our reason and to understand that faith is not blind. My faith, and please God, the faith of everyone here, is not blind. It rests on something. It rests on a number of things, not least of which is my own experience of God, but it also has something substantial which can be claimed through history. We're not talking about a galaxy long, long ago, far, far away when we talk about Jesus. We're talking about a precise moment in history which has been testified to by countless testimonies, and you and I have access to them.
This Ave Maria program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit CMF Curo. Your search for affordable health care stops here. Since 2014, CMF Curo has provided Catholics with affordable health care sharing that goes beyond insurance. With programs that cost less than many COBRA and ACA-sponsored plans, CMF Curo is a Catholic health sharing experience that enables you to live fully alive while saving money. Call 1-833-GET-CURO to find affordable Catholic health care now. That's 1-833-GET-CURO. Location, location, location. These are the three most important factors in real estate. The same might be said for colleges. Trudging through snow to get to an 8 a.m. statistics class is a much different experience than breezing by a palm tree to the raucous applause of a laughing gull. With the average temperature of 84 degrees and wetland nature as your backdrop, it's no wonder students tend to stay once they visit our campus. Ave Maria University, your future location, location, location. Visit avemaria.edu.
Hey, good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. I thank you for joining me on this Thanksgiving. Joining us right now is Melanie Kirkpatrick, the author of Thanksgiving, the holiday at the heart of the American experience. She's a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, also a former deputy editor of the Wall Street Journal's editorial page, and has authored Escape from North Korea, the untold story of Asia's Underground Railroad, which our friends at World Magazine named it as its 2013 Book of the Year. Melanie's lived in Tokyo, Toronto, Hong Kong, Honolulu, and Manhattan. Currently resides in rural Connecticut with her husband, Jack David. Good to have you with me, Melanie. Thanks.
It's great to be back, Al. Happy Thanksgiving.
And to you, too. Hong Kong, are you following it carefully now?
Oh, I certainly am, with great admiration for the young protesters who are out there day after day, weekend after weekend.
It's amazing. Any predictions on outcomes?
It's very hard to predict.
Right.
China isn't likely to give in, so it's very hard to say.
Yeah, yeah. No, I have the same feeling about it. Well, let's come back to Thanksgiving. You write that it's the holiday at the heart of the American experience. That's actually a pretty bold statement, so why don't you tell us why you think so?
For one thing, Al, it's our oldest tradition, dating back this Thanksgiving, 398 years. And I think that the first Thanksgiving, or what we call the first Thanksgiving, points the way to the multicultural people we've become.
Mm-hmm.
It was a time when the English settlers and the Wampanoan Indians came together to celebrate a harvest, and in years to come, there would be war and a lot of bloodshed. But at that moment in time, the two people might have been wary of one another, but they had come together in peace. And second, it's also very much a part of some of the most important aspects of American history. The first presidential proclamation was George Washington's, calling for a Thanksgiving. That was our first Thanksgiving as a nation.
When did he date it?
It was 1789. Okay. It was at the time of the first Congress, and the members of Congress had been meeting in New York City, then the capital, for a number of months. September came around, and they wanted to take a break, a well-deserved one, I should say.
Okay.
And some members of Congress wanted to ask the president to call a Thanksgiving. And one of the interesting things I found out in my research was that this idea was controversial. Hard to believe, but it was controversial on two points.
One was
that it was viewed as a religious holiday, and therefore the president, the federal government, should stay clear of it. And the second point was that the president didn't have the authority to call a national Thanksgiving.
Okay.
It should be left to the individual governors of the 13 states. So
those arguments are as current today as they were then.
Indeed, though I don't think anybody would think of applying them to the idea of national Thanksgiving.
No. But in right. terms of other things, yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, and I think Washington's response really showed what a great man he was. Congress, in the end, voted to ask the president. I don't know the exact vote, but they voted to ask the president to call a Thanksgiving, and a delegation went to see him. And he did so. But in doing so, he, instead of demanding that every American celebrate this Thanksgiving, he requested the governors to call the Thanksgiving on the date that he, Washington, had specified in their own state.
Interesting.
And of course they did, because Washington's authority was so great.
Well, so he actually used his moral authority.
Yeah, and he did something else, too.
Yeah.
We always think about Thanksgiving as the beginning of the giving season.
Mm-hmm.
Americans are the most generous people in the world, and Washington was a generous man. He usually kept his generosity quiet, but this time he made a donation to a local church in New York City for the benefit of the poor, and he made it public. And I think that he was sending a message to the American people to follow his example.
Interesting. Was he very aware of his historic role as a model for future presidents?
Yes, he was, very much so. And he realized that his presidency was unique,
yeah.
and that it was up to him to set both the tone and the substance, and to follow, of course, the Constitution. And that was the point of this first Thanksgiving. One of the points was to give thanks for the Thanksgiving,
okay.
for the Constitution,
okay.
and for the coming together of the people of this new nation.
What was the particular day? Was it a fall date, November?
It was, and here too he had he set a precedent. He called it for the last Thursday of November.
Okay.
And when Lincoln got round to reviving the tradition as a national holiday, that's the date he chose, because Washington had chosen it.
Interesting.
And the other thing Washington did in his proclamation was he made it clear that this was the Thanksgiving Day was to be celebrated by people of all religious denominations. It was an ecumenical holiday.
Yeah, very good. Any presidents, you mentioned it fell out of favor. Was the holiday neglected by future presidents?
Well, this is an interesting story too, Al. Jefferson famously refused to call a national Thanksgiving for the states' rights region,
okay.
the reason that I mentioned. When he was governor of Virginia, he did call a Thanksgiving, but as president, he wouldn't do it. And Madison, I think it was, called a Thanksgiving at the end of the War of 1812.
Okay.
But between Washington and Lincoln, presidents generally refused to do so for on the state rights issue. At the same time, Thanksgivings were widely celebrated around the growing country. Not every state, but many states did celebrate Thanksgiving, but it was always they didn't coordinate. It wasn't on the same day. That meant that the country wasn't celebrating as one nation. They were celebrating as people from Massachusetts or Connecticut
sure.
or wherever.
Sure. Yeah. Let me go to something since you brought up the multicultural dimension of this. You quote a Native American, Bill Waston, who said the first Thanksgiving was all right. It started to fall apart after that. Tell me a little bit about how Native Americans might regard Thanksgiving.
I wrote a chapter about Native Americans and Thanksgiving, and as I was reporting this or researching this, I didn't know what to expect.
Yeah.
There have been several Native American groups over the years, starting in the 60s or the 70s, that rejected Thanksgiving and did so very publicly. There's a group of New England Indians who stage a protest in Plymouth every Thanksgiving Day, and in California on Alcatraz Island, there was a protest as well. A group called it themselves the Un-Thanksgiving. But as I began to research it, I found something very, very different. The people, the Native American leaders I spoke to, for the most part, said that Thanksgiving was a time of reflection on the tragic history of Native Americans after the arrival of the European settlers. But at the same time, they were Americans, and of course they wanted to celebrate Thanksgiving. The best example of that was the Alcatraz Un-Thanksgiving that I mentioned. The Native American organization that sponsored that changed the name a number of years ago because they thought it was inappropriate. And today they do have a celebration starting at dawn on Alcatraz, and they have a kind of service of remembrance of Native Americans who came before them. And then they all get back on the ferry, get back to the pier in San Francisco and get home in time to put a turkey in the oven.
That's fascinating. You write too that, we today, when we think of Thanksgiving, we think, of course, of the Pilgrims, but the Pilgrims didn't take their place at the Thanksgiving table until the 19th century. Well, how? Why?
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, a couple of reasons for that. The Pilgrims became associated with Thanksgiving as the result of two things that happened. One was that Pilgrim documents were found in the 19th century that talked about what we call the first Thanksgiving. There are two eyewitness accounts, and both very brief, but they weren't widely known until the 19th century. At the same time, there was, at the time of the 1820, the bicentennial of the arrival of the Mayflower, a holiday started, or it started a little before then, but there was a holiday that now people haven't heard of, but it's called Forefathers Day, and it was started, well, actually more at the time of the Revolution, and then the big culmination was 1820, and it was started by a group of people in Plymouth, Massachusetts, who wanted to remember the Pilgrims, and so as the 19th century came, and then this big celebration in 1820, the Pilgrims and were widely celebrated around and thought of, and people really hadn't thought about them before. And then they became associated with the holiday as the century went on.
We'll come back on the other side of the break and continue our conversation. My guest is Melanie Kirkpatrick. Thanksgiving, the holiday at the heart of the American experience. I'm Al Cresta.
This Ave Maria program is brought to you by the following nonprofit underwriter.
Catholic Charities enabled 500,000 people last year to reach financial self-sufficiency. Consider a donor-advised fund with Catholic Charities. Streamline your charitable giving while supporting the causes you care about. Consider a donor-advised fund with Catholic Charities. Learn more about how you can maximize your charitable donations with a simple, flexible, and efficient giving tool. Visit ccusa.gives. That's ccusa.gives.
Unborn children are under attack as never before. Unseen, helpless, and voiceless, they need you. If we don't stand up for the unborn, who will? And yes, it is possible to defend and rescue the unborn in acts of peace and love. Learn how you can defend the unborn and reach out to their mothers in a new, exciting, bold, and effective mission called Red Rose Rescue. Plan to attend the Red Rose Rescue National Pro-Life Conference. Join me, Monica Miller, and Janet Smith, Joe Scheidler, Father Fidelis Moshensky, and other great speakers, Saturday, December 12th at the Embassy Suites in St. Charles, Missouri. Attend virtually, online, or in person. That's Saturday, December 12th. For all details and to register, see RedRoseRescue.com. Again, RedRoseRescue.com.
Hi, I'm Al Cresta. Over the last 50 years, we've had some of the greatest popes since the Reformation era. So why are things such a mess in American Catholicism? How do we analyze and confront the attacks we're facing? How do we identify wolves in sheep's clothing? How do we re-evangelize the baptized? Dr. Ralph Martin makes sense of a church in crisis and shows pathways forward. He'll make sense of a disordered world. Go to AveMariaRadio.net and you'll find it in our online bookstore.
I'm Dr. Stan Williams, and this is the logic of Catholicism. Solanus Casey said, appreciation is as necessary for social order and harmony as are the laws of gravity for the physical world. St. John writes, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was made flesh and lived among us. John's referring, of course, to Jesus as the Word, which in Greek is logos, and that's where we get the concept of order, reason, and logic. People with Jesus could see, hear, and touch him. With their senses, they eventually reasoned that Jesus was the incarnation of God, who beforehand they had only known by faith. Thus, the incarnation unites faith and reason. Today, tell someone you appreciate Jesus, because he revealed how faith and reason together are, well, logical. And that's the logic of Catholicism. Explore more at AveMariaRadio.net. Under resources, look for me, Dr. Stan Williams.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchak.
Do you ever just feel off, but you don't know why? Maybe everything seems fine, but you just feel down or disconnected. Well, you're in luck, because I've got just the thing to help you get your mood back on track. A new study by Texas A&M found that making small changes, like reminding yourself to smile more, can actually have a significant impact on your overall mood. Researchers caution that they don't mean to suggest that a person can smile their way to happiness, especially if someone is dealing with serious emotional problems. But they say the study is important because it highlights just how much our emotions take their cue from things like body posture or facial expressions. So go ahead. Give yourself permission to smile. It might be just what the doctor ordered. I'm Dr. Greg Popchak, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
And good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. With me is Melanie Kirkpatrick, author of Thanksgiving, the holiday at the heart of the American experience. Before the break, we were talking about Forefathers Day, which, if you're unfamiliar with it, don't feel bad. I hadn't heard about it myself until I read Melanie's book. But when did the pilgrims, as we kind of envision them today, finally make their way into the public imagination regarding Thanksgiving? When are they? How late was it?
It really was toward the second half of the 19th century that the pilgrims were closely connected with Thanksgiving. And, in lots of popular imagination, too. You know, one of the things that was popular at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century was Thanksgiving postcards. People would send postcards to one another, sending holiday greetings, and they often showed pictures of the pilgrims and the Indians. And then, of course, there are lots of famous, several famous paintings now of the arrival of the Mayflower, again, dating from the end of the 19th or the early 20th centuries.
Mm-hmm.
Forefathers Day fell out of fashion quite quickly after the bicentennial in 1820.
Okay.
But it's still celebrated a few places around the country. My husband and I went to the Forefathers celebration in Plymouth a couple of years ago, and that was a lot of fun.
Yeah. I'd never heard of it until I read your book, so it's completely lost on me. What is it in the popular picture of Thanksgiving, which is historically wrong and maybe even misleading?
That's a big question. For sure, in the popular pictures of Thanksgiving and the kinds of stuff you and I did when we were growing up in grade school, the representation of the Native Americans was off. There's a famous painting of the pilgrims and the Indians sitting outside at a Thanksgiving table called, let me look up the title here, it's The First Thanksgiving at Plymouth, and it was it would be instantly, you would know it if you saw it.
Yeah.
It was painted by a woman called Jenny Bronscombe, and she got the spirit of the event correct, I think, but the details were wrong. For example, and this is very typical of representations of the pilgrims were, you always see them in wearing black and gray and buckles on their caps, that
right.
sort of thing. Well, actually, they wore colorful clothes and no buckles on their hats. And the Native Americans are often portrayed with big, Indian headdresses, wearing them. And the Indians of New England did not wear headdresses.
Okay.
Those were the Plains Indians
yes.
who did so. Pictures show men and women seated together at a table, and that's not authentic either. The women would have been cooking. The men would have been seated at the table. But the spirit of conviviality, feasting
yes.
in Thanksgiving, I think, is accurate.
And what was the nature? What was the relationship like between those settlers and the indigenous people of that era?
Well, there was a wary respect. I think the Native Americans and the Pilgrims, the Confederation, the Wampanoag Confederation of Indian Tribes, had signed a peace treaty with the Pilgrims, and that was surely something that both sides could have been thankful for.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
At the same time, there was still suspicion.
Yeah.
And we note in one of the eyewitness accounts that the Pilgrims, as part of this three-day festival, shot off arms. That means they fired their weapons. They did a display of their weapons, maybe target practice or shooting at some fowl or in the air or whatever. But you have to think that maybe the reason for that was to let the Native Americans know that the Pilgrims, had these guns
yeah.
and knew how to use them.
Yeah.
At the same time, the Pilgrims would have been wary, too. There were only, there were half as many Pilgrims at the first Thanksgiving as there were Indian men.
Oh, okay.
We know from one of the accounts that the 90 braves came. Now, and the Pilgrims, I think, were only around 45, and that included women and children. So you can just imagine that there could be concern of one another.
Yeah.
At the same time, we also know that they played games, and they certainly ate well. The Indians brought three deer, which really probably was the centerpiece of the meals that they ate. So if you want to be authentic when you sit down to Thanksgiving dinner, make sure you have venison on the menu.
That's good. That's good. Who's Sarah Joseph Hale?
Sarah Joseph Hale is the greatest American woman few people have ever heard of.
Okay.
She was editor of the most popular magazine of the pre-Civil War era called Godey's Ladies' Book. And one of her passions was a national Thanksgiving. She campaigned for it for decades in her magazine, and she was such a famous personage that when she wrote letters to presidents of the United States, you know, asking them to call a national Thanksgiving, they wrote back. And they said, no, we're not going to do it, but they wrote back, which was an indication of, I think, how powerful she was. Then in 1863, she wrote to Lincoln with her suggestion. Now, of course, the war was in progress then, and Lincoln decided to call a national Thanksgiving. He chose the last Thursday of November because that was the date that Washington had called. His proclamation is a beautiful piece of prose, and if you've not seen it, I recommend that you take a look at it. It begins with a description of all the blessings that the American people should be grateful for.
Mm-hmm.
And it basically is, Gettysburg had taken place a few months earlier, and that was a turning point in the war, and it now looked like the Union was going to be victorious eventually.
Yeah.
But so this idea of a national Thanksgiving was a way, I think, of looking forward to peace that was eventually going to come. In it, he asked the American people to celebrate with one heart and one voice.
How was that received in the South?
Oh, very. I don't think anybody celebrated right. in the South
yeah.
at the time. And it wasn't until after the war ended that, of course, they had celebrated before the Civil War in some of the states, and then again after the Civil War. And then with a little bit of reluctance, not every state was keen to adopt a Yankee tradition.
Yeah, okay. So that was seen as a Yankee tradition because it originates in New England? Is that?
Yeah. It was not by everybody, but by some Southerners. It was seen as a damned Yankee tradition.
Okay, right. One of the things I love about Lincoln's statement, by the way, is reproduced in the book that Melanie's
yes.
given us, Thanksgiving, the Holiday at the Heart of the American Experience, is that many of us have probably been in moods where bad things are going on in our lives. We've probably churlishly said, what's there to give thanks for? But he says, in the midst of a civil war of unequaled magnitude and severity, so he's not in any way ignoring the terrible events surrounding him. In the midst of a civil war of unequaled magnitude and severity, which has sometimes seemed to foreign states to invite and to provoke their aggression, peace has been preserved with all nations. Order has been maintained. The laws have been respected and obeyed, and harmony has prevailed everywhere except in the theater of military conflict, while that theater has been greatly contradicted by the advancing armies and navies of the Union. I just think that he's an incredibly gifted stylist. People should remember that. But he's also strikes me as a terribly straightforward and honest writer. Would you agree?
I do agree. And I would also notice that I would also note that he doesn't refer to the enemies at all.
Right.
It's this he sees every American, North and South, as having a place in this national Thanksgiving.
We should mention too that you have in this there's a bunch of recipes, which it's historically it's delightful book, but you've also got Thanksgiving recipes. Where are these from?
I did, Alan. I'll tell you, while I was researching this book, and of course it's a serious history written, I hope, in a way that readers find entertaining.
It's delightful, yes.
But as I was writing it, my husband kept saying, you have to include recipes, you have to include recipes. And I said, no, nobody wants to read recipes. Well, in the end, he was right. And I decided to include a section on historic recipes and menus, which helped to tell the story of Thanksgiving. And there's also a section on readings for around the Thanksgiving table, the Pilgrims' descriptions of the first Thanksgiving, Lincoln's proclamation, and so forth.
Yeah.
But the recipes were a hoot to research, I must say. from the first American cookbook, I found a couple of recipes for pumpkin pudding and apple tarts and cranberry pie and stuff. And then as things went, through the centuries, there is a menu from 1864 for wounded soldiers at a hospital in Washington, D.C., which I thought was interesting in its opulence, but also in the fact that it was provided for by ordinary citizens all around America, the Union, this is. And they would donate the food or donate money for the food for the wounded soldiers.
Well, this is great. This would enhance any Thanksgiving celebration, is to choose one of the recipes at least in here and enjoy them. Melanie, thank you for taking the time to be with us and for the work that you put into Thanksgiving, the holiday at the heart of the American experience. We'll have it available for people to buy. Thanks.
Thank you, Al, and happy Thanksgiving.
And to you.
Solidarity HealthShare began out of the Christian tradition of neighbor helping neighbor. They're a nonprofit medical cost-sharing ministry in which their members share in each other's eligible medical expenses. Solidarity HealthShare is not insurance, but rather an alternative way to pay for medical costs that adheres to the teachings of the Catholic Church. They'll never share in a medical care that goes against their values and morals, such as abortion, contraception, and sterilization. More information available at SolidarityHealthShare.org or at 844-313-4999.
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
There's a simple step to raising a more grateful child. I used to say, easy, eliminate half of their material possessions. I don't say that anymore. That's ridiculous. I say 75%. They don't even miss 50. 22 stuffed animals, you go down to 11. Not exactly a hardship. Simple step to raising a more grateful child. Don't be so free with the material stuff. Research has shown more generous people, by and large, have less. You give a child less, he's more willing to share it. He also is more able to occupy himself with things like boxes and dirt balls and rocks, worms, stuff that doesn't cost a whole lot of anything.
This Ave Maria program is brought to you by the following nonprofit underwriter.
With 1 in 9 Americans struggling with hunger, Catholic Charities distributed over 70 million meals across the United States last year, along with life-changing services that empower people to move beyond poverty. Consider a donor-advised fund with Catholic Charities. Streamline your charitable giving while supporting the causes you care about. To learn more, go to ccusa.gives. That's ccusa.gives.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. A reason why Mass is an appropriate way to celebrate Thanksgiving Day, by the way, is that the Greek word Eucharist means Thanksgiving. And I always like to point out that when we talk about Thanksgiving, the ability to give thanks, we are ultimately talking about the Eucharist. So I love Thanksgiving because it implies, right, that there's somebody to give thanks to. And I often point out that the tragedy of atheism is that ultimately there's no one to thank for the extraordinary beauty that we see, the goodness that we see, and the truths that we uncover. There's no one to give thanks to for that if you're an atheist. And yet the very fact of the capacity to give thanks presupposes that there is someone to receive thanks. It's a kind of a backdoor way of implying the existence of God. And the Mass has always been associated with the desire to give thanks to God for the many blessings we've received. And Catholics who first came to the United States, one of the first things they did was offer Mass of Thanksgiving. They were thanking God for preserving their life after a long voyage over the Atlantic Ocean. And by the way, Catechism of the Catholic Church reinforces this connection between the Mass and a spirit of thanksgiving. I'll read from it. This is 1359 and 1360. The Eucharist, the sacrament of our salvation accomplished by Christ on the cross, is also a sacrifice of praise and thanksgiving for the work of creation. In the Eucharistic sacrifice, the whole of creation loved by God is presented to the Father through the death and the resurrection of Christ. Through Christ, the Church can offer the sacrifice of praise and thanksgiving for all that God has made good, beautiful, and just in creation and in humanity. The Eucharist is a sacrifice of thanksgiving to the Father, a blessing by which the Church expresses her gratitude to God for all his benefits, for all that he has accomplished through creation, redemption, and sanctification. Eucharist means, first of all, thanksgiving. So it's good. Eucharist is thanksgiving. Thanksgiving is at the heart of the American experience, and Eucharist thanksgiving is also at the heart of the Catholic experience.
This hour, Cresta in the Afternoon is co-produced by Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
In the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
America is as divided as it has been in 150 years.
Politics is symptomatic of the culture.
They don't have a personal relationship with Christ.
We've been sacramentalized, but not evangelized.
Why should Washington listen to us when our own house is in disarray?
The Church's greatest riches are her people.
Share the contagious joy of being a friend of Christ.
Story after story after story of people who have had inexplicable healings.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
That's beautifully said, Al.
Thanks for your voice for liberty.
It's like a homecoming each time on your program.
Clear to me that you've thought these things through at a deep level.
Let's build the church, and then we'll bless the nations.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta, thanking you for joining me on this special Thanksgiving edition of Cresta in the Afternoon. We're going to be taking time to look more deeply at, you might say, the social benefits of gratitude. My guest, Dr. Gregory Popcheck, will be taking a look at recent studies showing that there are many psychological benefits of being grateful. I think you'd be surprised at some of them. And there's actually great social benefits to Thanksgiving as well. Also in this hour, we're going to take time with Dr. Robert Tracy McKenzie. He's a professor of history at Wheaton College, who has done some outstanding work on the, again, first Thanksgiving. There are lessons in this study of the first Thanksgiving, lessons in us about how to love God and also how to learn from history. And that's what Dr. McKenzie specializes in. So we're going to take time to look at this first Thanksgiving as a keystone of America's national and spiritual identity, and how we can learn from this harvest feast what actually happened and what difference it makes for the way we conduct our lives as Catholics who are citizens of the United States of America. So that's coming up in this hour of Cresta in the Afternoon. Also, I want to continue to remind us of the extraordinary amount of biblical material dealing with Thanksgiving. In Romans chapter 1, for instance, St. Paul is talking about how God has made himself known through all that he has made. His invisible power, his eternal nature, have been clearly seen through what he has made. And so nobody has an excuse
for denying the existence of God. But what St. Paul goes on to say is that the pagans, who he has in mind, that what they do is they suppress the truth of God in unrighteousness. In other words, they practice denial. They deny what should be evident to their senses. And by suppressing the truth in denial, their minds become darkened. In other words, by refusing to acknowledge the truth in front of you, you blind yourself to other truths that should be evident to you. But they suppress the truth in unrighteousness, and their minds grow dark. And so what's the first negative consequence to that action of suppressing the knowledge of God? They failed to give thanks. So the first step into the darkness of the pagan mind is the refusal to give thanks for the goodness that we see in creation. Stay with me. We've got Dr. McKenzie coming up, but also Dr. Greg Popcheck on the benefits of gratitude. Well, thank you so much for joining me on this Thanksgiving 2019. Thanksgiving is a theologically loaded word. Many people think of gratitude as just kind of something which is a mature adult or even a mature child learns to give for the blessings, the good things that comes their way. But it is at the heart of biblical theology. So, for instance, in Romans chapter 1, where St. Paul is talking about the unbelieving world's refusal to recognize the design of the universe, to recognize the interior voice of God as their conscience, and they're suppressing that truth in unrighteousness, he says, although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God, nor did they give thanks to him. This is one of the most, again, theologically loaded passages of the New Testament. And yet gratitude for us is something as, you know, common as saying thank you for some kind gesture that somebody shows us. So today we'll talk a little bit about Thanksgiving with my guest, Dr. Gregory Popcheck. Greg's the director of the Pastoral Solutions Institute, a Catholic telecounseling practice providing marriage and mental health counseling services to Catholics worldwide. He and his wife, Lisa, are authors of over 20 books on relationships and spirituality, and you can hear them daily on More to Life at 10 Eastern Time on the Ave Maria Radio app or at any of the EWTN stations around the country. Greg, good to have you here.
Well, I'm thankful to be here and thankful for you, Al.
Thank you. And I'm grateful to have you with me. You sent me a piece here talking about gratitude and how it is. Gratitude is one of those things which there's a lot of good research that has been done on, and its positive benefits.
I mean, there's a ton of research, and there are so many benefits that you'd be shocked. I mean, gratitude doesn't just impact our emotional health in positive ways. It strengthens our relationships. It helps us to be healthier. It can lower your blood pressure. It can help you recover from illness more quickly. I mean, it's really remarkable. If somebody was able to make gratitude into a pill, they'd become a billionaire overnight.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, let's talk about some of those benefits of gratitude, some of the emotional benefits.
Sure.
Of the list that you sent me, one here, let's take the most basic of them. It makes us happier.
Yeah, well, so, you know, there's such a thing as a happiness set point, okay? And that's the amount of happiness that we just sort of on average experience in our lives. And that happiness set point is actually very difficult to change. But research shows that doing something as simple as keeping a gratitude journal can increase your happiness set point by at least 10%. Now, if I were to say to you, I've got a trick that can help you, that would take 30 seconds and make you 10% happier in your entire life, would you want to do it?
Of course.
And really just like writing 3 to 5 things down that you're grateful for a couple of times a week can increase your overall sense of happiness by at least 10% in a relatively short amount of time.
You know, that's, again, a very, very quick exercise. It doesn't take much to do that.
Well, and it's something that's built into our faith as well. If you're not a prayerful person, you know, it takes, I think, real effort to sit down and say, you know, I should be thankful for something. But as Christians, you know, we're constantly reminded to give thanks to God for
right.
all the millions of blessings that he pours out on us every single day. And so this is just another example of why faith contributes so positively to overall health outcomes, because it reminds us of the need to be grateful. And, you know, just to make a side point here, God doesn't need our gratitude. He doesn't need anything from us. He's perfectly self-sufficient. But we need to be grateful, and God gives us another blessing for that gratitude in terms of greater happiness, greater health, and closer relationships.
In this list of gratitude and the emotional benefits of it, it also points out, number three here, that mm-hmm. it enhances our other positive emotions.
That's right. You know, so for example, it can help to decrease our experience of envy. You know, we all fall into that trap of seeing somebody who either gets a benefit or experiences a blessing or has some accomplishment that we wish that we had.
Right.
And that's fine. That's part of the human condition. But people who practice gratitude, who are regularly thankful to God or in general for the things that they have, experience much less envy and, in fact, are able to be grateful for the blessings that other people have, because it reminds them, for instance, it reminds Christians that God is good and that God will attend to the longings of their heart as well. So it helps to reorient the way we think about the blessings that other people have as well.
Yeah. You know, something here, the fourth point under emotional benefits is mm-hmm. it increases our self-esteem, and I think that's fascinating, because we're usually giving gratitude for something other, so, and yet it enhances our own sense of self.
Well, because it can increase our own sense of self-efficacy. So self-efficacy is our ability to set and meet goals, right? But what often happens with people is that we accomplish stuff, but there's a whole long list of other stuff that's got to be accomplished, so we never give ourselves credit for the things that we do. We're always just on to the next thing. Pausing to be grateful increases self-esteem by reminding us of all the ability that we have to set and meet goals, and it helps us to feel better about ourselves, it helps us to feel more connected to God's providence, and it helps us to be more hopeful about our ability to get things done that still have to be done. So that's how it contributes to self-esteem.
There are also social benefits, and one of the yep. ones that caught my attention is that number seven, gratitude improves our romantic relationships. That's one that I wouldn't have put on my list right away, but it makes sense. Go ahead.
Well, of course it does, yeah. And actually, I talk about this in my book, The Exceptional 7%, Nine Secrets of the World's Happiest Couples. The couples who are in truly satisfying relationships really work hard to be grateful to each other. You know, story of a friend of ours was helping us with some project around the house, and we were thanking her, and she said, "Oh, you don't need to thank me. We're family." And my wife said, "Well, no. That's why we need to thank you, because we want to keep you family, you know." And you know, people who love each other don't take each other for granted. And so, you know, being able to see those little acts of service, not just as stuff you have to do because you're stuck with me, but as gifts that we give each other because we love each other, is really important. And expressing that gratitude, saying thank you, saying I appreciate you, saying this means the world to me, you know, lets us know that even in small things, we can make a big difference in each other's lives.
You know, taking each other for granted is something which is very common in long-term relationships. We simply assume mm-hmm. That the person knows we love them, the person, our spouse, knows we're grateful for them. And it always reminds me of that scene in Fiddler on the Roof. You know,
for 25 years, I darned your socks.
Right.
Yeah, that. Yeah,
right.
Yeah, I get you. Yeah, and it's right. You know, we do. we appreciate these things that our spouse or our kids or, you know, family member does for us, but we don't ever point it out. And,
right.
And I think maybe this Thanksgiving, it would be great just to take some time to not just thank that person on that day, but be get in the habit of being more thankful for those simple acts of service that
sure.
That people do every day. In fact, you know, there was an interesting study about gratitude that that had people write a letter to somebody that influenced them or that was a blessing to them. It wasn't necessarily somebody in their past. It was just somebody that meant a lot to them, and they just wrote a one-page letter describing what they were grateful for that this person had done. And in doing that, what they found was that both the giver and the receiver of the letter had an increase in overall mental health and happiness that extended for months after the letter was written.
That's amazing.
That really is.
That is, and that's good news.
And you can actually watch the video of this this experiment if you just look up the gratitude letter study.
Gratitude letter study. Okay.
Yeah, it's really really powerful to see the impact that these letters have on people. You know, mothers or daughters writing to their moms. People writing to a teacher. Just to see their faces as they read the letter. It's just so powerful. We can give a beautiful gift to others by letting them know the impact that they've had on our lives, even for simple things.
Very good. By the way, have you seen the movie, the feature film on Mr. Rogers? It's outstanding. But there's one thing in it in particular that got my attention. He at one point, he asks the interviewer that he's working with to just take 60 seconds and remember all those people who had a role in making him the person he now is. Yeah. And implicit in that whole thing, of course, are feelings of gratitude, which are going to be stirred up by that kind of exercise. And I thought, that's fascinating. 60 seconds, that's all it took.
And it makes a big difference because it connects us with all the people who love us and who have sacrificed to help us get where we are and be who we are. And it reminds us that we're not alone. And that's just so important.
Number 9 here, gratitude and social benefits, is that it increases social support. This is very practical, isn't it?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, nobody wants to feel like they're alone, right? Mm-hmm. We all need help from others. We're social beings in our very biology. And you know, by being grateful to others, what does it do? It makes them want to be around us more, right? It feels good to be told thank you. It feels good to have somebody say, you really make a difference in my life, and I really appreciate this gift or that effort, or thank you so much for whatever. And so it increases the strength of our social networks. It makes people want to be around us more, to offer support more. I'm not suggesting that you do this to be as a manipulative sort of a thing,
right,
but
it
certainly strengthens relationship by being grateful.
Sure. It benefits, again, personality and our own formation. But let's go to the one that's so basic that I mentioned at the beginning of the segment here. St. Paul refers to it. That it increases our sense of spirituality.
That's
number
right.
12
well,
here.
Yeah. Well, you know, there was a study that was done in 2010 that talked about how gratitude increases our spiritual sensibilities as well, which only makes sense. I mean, you know, if I'm being thankful, who am I being thankful to exactly?
Yes.
You know,
exactly.
Am I just? And people will say, to my ears anyway, odd things like, you know, I'm being thankful to the universe. But you know, at some point, you've got to realize there's something more than just space that I'm thanking.
The universe doesn't say you're welcome. So.
exactly. It's a start. You know, God will take whatever we give him,
right.
And he'll work with any of that. So I don't want to discourage anybody if that's where they're at in their spiritual journey. But making that effort to be grateful and to say thank you implies that we're saying thank you to someone.
That's right.
And it reminds us that there are deeper spiritualities hidden even in the simplest things.
Yeah. I don't know who said it, but the great tragedy of atheism is that ultimately there's no one to thank. So, how do people stay in touch with you, Greg?
CatholicCounselors.com.
All right. Thanks, Greg. We'll talk again. Have a great Thanksgiving.
God bless, Al. Thank you.
Dr. Gregory Popcheck, Director of the Pastoral Solutions Institute. I'm Al Kresta.
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
What is criticism exactly? If you pay close attention, do you notice what most criticism is? Oh, it's not because you're doing something wrong or hurtful, something that needs corrected. Most criticism is, you're not doing it the way I would do it. Or you're not doing it the way I want you to do it. That's what most criticism is. And you have to get good at sorting that out. Otherwise, you're going to get real upset when anyone says anything about what you are doing. Now, of course, you could turn this on yourself. Do you do that? Is most of your criticism a message to someone else that says, you're not doing it the way I would do it? Well, save your criticism for things that are really wrong.
What is catechesis and why do we care? The job of catechesis is to reveal all the joy as well as the demands of the way of Christ, says the Catholic Catechism. The way of Christ is summed up in the catechesis of the Beatitudes. Jesus gave us the 8 Beatitudes in his Sermon on the Mount. The Catholic Catechism tells us this teaching is the only path that leads to the eternal beatitude, happiness, for which the human heart longs. The catechesis of sin and forgiveness challenges us. Unless man acknowledges that he is a sinner, states the catechism, he cannot know the truth about himself, which is a condition for acting justly, and without the offer of forgiveness, man could not bear the truth. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Location, location, relocation. Studies show more than a third of college students transfer, and half of those do it more than once. He reminds us of St. Augustine's quote, "Our souls are restless until they rest in thee." At Ave Maria University, we challenge this group to visit us, stroll down our palm tree paths, spike a shot on our sand volleyball court, or partake in an outdoor devotion. There's a reason when students visit Ave Maria, they tend to stay. Ave Maria University, your relocation destination. Visit avemaria.edu.
This program is brought to you in part by Charity Mobile, a proud partner of Ave Maria Radio for over 15 years. Charity Mobile is the pro-life cell phone company and has sent nearly $2 million to thousands of pro-life charities. 4G LTE coverage is available nationwide, and 5% of your monthly plan price goes to your favorite pro-life charity. A video introduction is available at charitymobile.com. Charity Mobile. Everyday living, effortless giving. CharityMobile.com.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization, Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 80% of the referral check to Ave Maria Radio and Students for Life. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
This Ave Maria program is brought to you by the following nonprofit underwriter.
When you give, you want your charitable donations to be as effective and efficient as possible. Streamline your charitable giving while supporting the causes you care about. Consider a donor-advised fund with Catholic Charities. Learn more about how you can maximize your charitable donations with a simple, flexible, and efficient giving tool. Visit ccusa.gives. That's ccusa.gives.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Kresta. I thank you for joining me on this Thanksgiving Day. Taking a look again at the festival, the Feast of Thanksgiving. And going back to the very first one, my guest, Robert Tracy McKenzie, is chair of faith and learning and the professor of history at Wheaton College and the author of The First Thanksgiving, What the Real Story Tells Us About Loving God and Learning from History. You can follow him at his blog at faithandamericanhistory.wordpress.com. We'll have that linked for you at our site. And Dr. McKenzie, good to have you with me. Thank you.
Thank you, Al. It's my pleasure.
Let's talk about what's the evidence available to us about the first Thanksgiving.
It's a great question. It's a good historical question because that's where a historian always wants to start. The answer is a little bit surprising, and that's that there really isn't a great deal of evidence. In fact, the main source that we have for this event in 1621 comes from a pamphlet that contained a variety of documents about the Plymouth colony, including a single letter written back to England. And in this letter, there's one paragraph devoted to the event, a total of 115 words, four sentences. And that is the sum total of all the evidence that survives about the event that we that just has loomed so large in our memory.
Mm-hmm. And what's it tell us?
Well, it doesn't tell us very much, actually, at least not the things that we want it to tell us. It says that the harvest had been brought in, that the governor sent four men on fowling, as it was put, that is to say, to shoot birds for a celebration. It's clear that this was with a celebration as the objective, ultimately, they celebrated, and we don't know exactly how long they celebrated, but it seems to have been at least for multiple days. And the one other thing it tells us is that some point in that time period, the local Native American tribe showed up and joined in the celebration, the Wampanoag people, and they probably outnumbered the pilgrims 2 to 3 to 1 at least.
Okay.
And that's about all that we know.
So from that, Pizza. Is there any kind of oral tradition that's reliable?
Well, the short answer is no. The event is largely forgotten. This little pamphlet that is published in 1622 is really only published in England, and it largely disappears from circulation and doesn't show up again for more than two centuries. It actually shows up in the 1820s. And there was a New England minister who came across it and published it in a book about New England history in the 1840s. And from that period, from the 1620s to the 1840s, this event is just not remembered. The descendants of the pilgrims remember the pilgrims as the first comers, they would call them, or that sort of the founders of the Massachusetts colony ultimately. But they don't remember this event of celebration.
Hmm.
And so it really is two centuries after before it's first mentioned. I've actually unearthed, I think, 223 Thanksgiving proclamations that were issued at the state or local level before 1840, and the pilgrims are never mentioned a single time.
Mm-hmm.
So they really only sort of come back into our memory and become part of our heritage more than two centuries after the event itself.
What about the day of Thanksgiving that Washington declared in 1789?
So there are days of Thanksgiving, and certainly even in New England, some of the descendants of the pilgrims had begun within two or three generations to practice pretty regular days of Thanksgiving in the fall and days of humiliation and fasting in the spring. It just wasn't linked in any way to a specific event. It wasn't described as now we're imitating what the pilgrims did. So Washington does issue a day of national Thanksgiving in 1789, but that doesn't really set a pattern, at least at the presidential level. That's not something that's going to come to become a habit, an annual practice, until Abraham Lincoln, who from hindsight we would say he initiated sort of the pattern of annual Thanksgiving proclamations by the president when he does so during the Civil War in 1863.
Was there any controversy about a president declaring a day of Thanksgiving? Was that something that might have been argued should be left for the governors?
Yeah. There was some controversy. I think by and large, it was largely approved, but there were there was some controversy. One, those who took the separation of church and state, and I mean really devout Christians who took the,
sure,
the issue of separation of church and state seriously, thought that it wasn't necessarily a good precedent for the civil official, high civil official in the government, to be issuing days with religious significance like that. So that was an issue that was raised to some degree. One of the other things that was a little bit controversial was that it's very difficult for a president to issue a proclamation of Thanksgiving without making some kind of political statement.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think if you look at a lot of those presidential proclamations, they do. And if you look at Lincoln's in 1863, one of the things he basically says is, we want to thank God for how well the war is going. And that was something that Republicans and Democrats at the time in the North really strongly disagreed over. And so if you're a Democrat at the time, you probably see Lincoln trying to make some political statements in the process of making this religious decree. So that was a little bit controversial as well.
Talk to me about the context of the first Thanksgiving. What do we know about the relationship between the Pilgrims and the Native Americans in the region?
Right. It's a great question. And we're actually able to breathe life into that context much more than we can sort of the specific nuts and bolts of the Thanksgiving celebration in 1621. But so we know a variety of things. We know, for example, that the Native American population of that area of Massachusetts had really been decimated by disease in the two or three generations immediately preceding the Pilgrims' arrival. So there had been contact with various European, probably fishing boats, in the late 1500s and early 1600s, and that had brought certain kinds of diseases that weren't indigenous to North America and had a really devastating effect. So there had been a lot of upheaval in the Native American population, and some tribes have been affected more than others. And so when the Pilgrims arrive, the Native American peoples are significantly weakened from what they would have been just a few generations before. And the people that are settled right around Plymouth had been particularly hard hit by disease. And actually, because of that, I think probably welcomed the Pilgrims as a potential ally in some of their rivalries with other Native American peoples. So although there's a fair amount of suspicion on both sides, one of the things that seems pretty clear is that both the Pilgrims and the Wampanoag believed that they needed one another, or at the least that there was ways that a relationship could be mutually beneficial. And so they actually do enter into a more or less peaceful and beneficial relationship that lasts for several generations.
Really? It lasts that long? So it's not the first Thanksgiving was fine, but it's all been downhill since?
the first real outbreak of extensive violent conflict would have been actually in the 1670s and 1680s.
Okay.
So it's something that lasts for several decades at least.
What how do you account for that? I mean, that's good news, so I'm kind of wondering.
What is positive? Well, I think part of it is, again, that there was a kind of practical need that each had of the other, and I think that's part of it. Had the Pilgrims arrived, say, 30 or 40 years earlier, it might have been a temptation for the Wampanoag simply just to sort of swat them away or drive them back into the sea. So I think that's part of it. I also think the Pilgrims actually, unlike some later immigrants to the area, really didn't have broad ambitions for geographical expansion. They actually settle in a very dense way and stay within 15-20 miles of the coast for several decades. And so that sort of also alleviated potential for conflict as well. So it's not a warm and fuzzy story necessarily in the sense of great intimate friendship, but it's a story of success nonetheless, because they practically found it possible to get along and actually even to be a blessing to one another.
Let me ask a question which may have been irrelevant to them, but I'm curious. How would the Pilgrims and later the Puritans understand their relationship to the Native Americans? Would they have founded a settlement with them? Would they have allowed their sons and daughters to intermarry? What was the degree of separateness that they understood as necessary for, quote, holiness?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think there is a suspicion of the Native Americans because they see them as heathen, and one of the ways really that they understand the human condition is that our hearts are sort of naturally wicked, and we are subject to all manner of temptation.
Mm-hmm.
And they would have, I believe, tended to think that it was much easier for a Christian people to be corrupted by interaction with pagans than it was possible for pagans to be Christianized by believing peoples.
Okay.
So that doesn't mean that they necessarily avoided interaction. That's not what I'm suggesting at all. But they also don't engage in extensive efforts at missionary activities. That will come later, but it's actually the late 1600s before that's very extensive, and that's several generations removed from the Pilgrims.
Mm-hmm.
They certainly, I think, genuinely would like to be a blessing to them. And there is evidence that one of the Pilgrims, one of the prominent Pilgrims, a man named Edward Winslow, at one point travels to meet the chief of the Wampanoag and actually finds him suffering from a pretty serious illness and helps to nurse him to health. And so they desire to have that kind of positive influence. But I think they are fearful of what sort of intimate, ongoing interaction might mean for them.
Okay. Hold it there if you would, Dr. McKenzie. We'll come back on the other side of the break. Talking about the first Thanksgiving, what the real story tells us about loving God and learning from our history. My guest is Dr. Robert Tracy McKenzie. He's chair of faith and learning and professor of history at Wheaton College and author of The First Thanksgiving. I'm Al Cresta, and we'll be right back.
This Ave Maria program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit CMF Curo. If you're facing uncertainty with your current health care plan, now is the time to join CMF Curo. You can join any time during the year, and CMF Curo offers flexible Catholic healthcare solutions for individuals, families, and employers. CMF Curo is your personal healthcare advocate. Contact them today at mycatholichealthcare.com. That's mycatholichealthcare.com.
Pro-life across America, the billboard people.
How does the baby move in your tummy?
How does the baby eat?
Can the baby hear me?
How did the baby get in there?
Wow, a pregnancy can sure generate a lot of questions. But what's important is that a baby is a baby, inside and out of the womb. Not just after birth, but 9 months before, at conception.
That's right. Every baby is a miracle. Hello, my name is Marianne Kuharski. I'm the director of Pro-Life Across America. If you know someone who is pregnant or in need of alternatives or assistance, or would like to support the work of Pro-Life Across America, please visit our website at prolifeacrossamerica.org, or better yet, simply dial #250 on your cell phone and say the keyword pro-life. Pro-Life Across America is non-political and totally educational.
A baby's heart is beating 18 days from conception.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria Mutual Funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Maybe you've been hearing a lot about the need to make a spiritual communion while participating from home in a live-streamed or broadcast Mass. Maybe you've even prayed the prayer of spiritual communion. Spiritual communion is a concept that goes all the way back to the 4th century. It flourished in the Eastern Church and gradually moved west. Spiritual communion stresses the transcendence of God, where we unite our desires, intentions, and loves with the holy sacrifice of the Mass and the consecration of the Eucharist at the altar. Jesus, I embrace you and unite myself wholly to you.
You recently filed a federal civil rights lawsuit against Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf and the Secretary for the Pennsylvania Department of Health, challenging, among other things, the state's Orwellian contact tracing program. Under this program, Big Brother is alive and well in Pennsylvania. Indeed, the contact tracing program grants the government extraordinary power to impose draconian restrictions, including a 14-day quarantine, which is the equivalent of a house arrest. The restrictions are enforced through fines and criminal penalties, and there is no procedure for challenging the government's orders. If you or someone who may have had contact with you test positive for COVID-19, an army of contact tracers will hunt you down. Through this program, the government uses its authority to inquire into and search out the private associations of individuals and their children, tracing where they have been and who they were with. The breadth of government power under this program forces individuals to keep their children from attending public schools in person, to avoid seeking medical treatment, and to avoid businesses, restaurants, and other public or social events that may keep rosters, lists, video, or other ways to document persons who entered the business establishment or attended the event. The program also forces individuals to avoid worship services where pre-registration is required. The power grab by liberal politicians during this current pandemic is devastating to freedom. I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel for the American Freedom Law Center, bringing you this Faith and Freedom Minute.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. With me is Dr. Robert Tracy McKenzie. He is author of The First Thanksgiving, What the Real Story Tells Us About Loving God and Learning from History. How should we distinguish the aspirations of the pilgrims from those settlers who came to Jamestown?
Yeah, that's a good question. Their aspirations are very different. And one of the things that I think is so interesting about our history is that it makes a difference to the way we remember our past, whether we emphasize the pilgrims or the Jamestown colony is one of the first real important communities in the future United States. The Jamestown colony is founded primarily as a commercial venture. Mm-hmm. There had been a joint stock company established in London in the very early 1600s, and they had a vision of exploiting the natural resources of that area in coastal Virginia to, you know, make profit for their investors. They have a vision that it might be a lucrative place to develop wineries, and it might be a place to harvest silk from silkworms, and they imagine tropical fruits being able to grow there and so forth. And so most of the people that are attracted to that Jamestown settlement are part of that commercial venture. Now, some of them were investors, some of them are just manual laborers, some of them are skilled craftsmen who have been hired by the company to be part of the work. The very first ship that arrives at Jamestown, 1607, its passengers are exclusively male. And they're almost all single in their personal background. So you have more than 100 single men. And for many years after that, the gender ratio in the Virginia colony is overwhelmingly male. So even 6-to-1 as late as the, say, 1670s, 1680s.
Wow. I don't mean to be crude here, but do those males seek out wives among the Native Americans?
Well, they probably sought out companionship, if I could use that euphemism. But there wasn't much intermarriage. There might have been some, but I think those were more often exceptions to the rule.
Okay.
One of the things we would say about this population is extremely transient. The mortality rate is incredibly high. Okay. So it's just a very unstable population. But again, the colony hadn't been motivated by desire to create a stable community. It had been motivated by desire to generate profit.
Yeah.
And then we compare that to the Plymouth colony that's established in 1620, and it's overwhelmingly, not exclusively, but overwhelmingly a migration of families. They definitely are going, hoping to create a permanent new life for themselves, and they're concerned about the institutions that that helped create a community in addition to the family, such as the church, fairly quickly schools. And it's just a very different set of motives and a very different pattern.
So let's talk about what they wanted then. What did the pilgrims actually want? They wanted to establish a permanent settlement. For what reason?
Yeah, that's a great question. And any short answer tends to be a little bit misleading. I always push back against the very sort of simplistic statement that we hear and repeat, which is that their primary motivation was to search out religious freedom.
Right.
But I have to qualify that. They,
sure.
They definitely valued religious freedom, no doubt about that, although I would start with the observation that they didn't mean by religious freedom what we tend to mean.
Mm-hmm.
They understood liberty as not the freedom to do anything that you wished.
Right.
And in terms of religious liberty, they never would have understood it as simply obeying the dictates of your individual conscience.
Mm-hmm.
Liberty was the freedom to do what God required of you. And so their pastor in Holland, a man named John Robinson, said it's the Christian's liberty to love God in faith and serve his neighbor in love. And so liberty simply meant the freedom to do what God required, but not what you personally thought was right. But having said that, in Holland, where they had gone directly from England around 1608, they more or less had that kind of freedom. And so William Bradford, who will later become the governor of the colony, will remember their time in Holland as a time when they actually were allowed to organize a congregation without interference to worship God as they believed the Scripture required them to do, to raise their children as they believed the Scripture taught them to. And so they're not leaving Holland because of religious persecution. They had left England because of persecution against dissenters from the Church of England, but they weren't coming to Massachusetts from England. They were coming from Holland.
From Holland, where they had relative religious liberty.
Where they did.
Yeah.
And so when you read William Bradford talk about the conversations that are leading up to the decision to migrate, largely they're emphasizing two or three other factors that weren't strictly about freedom of worship. They're talking about the great difficulty that they have economically. There were laws in Leiden, where they lived most of the time, that pretty much restricted skilled crafts to native-born individuals. And so it's really strictly controlled who could earn living in certain ways.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were more or less confined to really tedious, backbreaking, low-paying kinds of jobs. They're also concerned about the influence of Dutch culture. They see the local Dutch believers as more permissive, actually encouraging a kind of environment that is detrimental to the faithfulness of their children, and that worries them a great deal. And they're also just concerned that their children, even if they're remaining faithful as Christian believers, they're becoming more and more Dutch and less English, and that's not what they want either.
Yeah.
So all these things sort of point up to the desirability of creating a new home where perhaps economic opportunity would be greater, where there would be less concerns about the culture's influences.
Once in America, did they have a different vision of civil culture than later Puritans?
So sometimes sometimes you will hear the pilgrims understood as fundamentally a different group from the Puritans.
Right.
I actually don't think of them in that way.
Okay.
I think it's a little misleading. I think of the pilgrims as a kind of subset of Puritans.
All right.
So we start with the Puritan movement in England as just a movement to purify the Church of England from remnants of Catholic practice and belief that they believe are not proper.
Right.
The pilgrims then become a subset within that group that are by far the most radical. So they were known as separatists, whereas most Puritans believed that they could reform the Church of England from within the church. The separatists ultimately reached the conclusion that the Church of England was not a true church at all, and to worship with it, to sit under the instruction of an Anglican minister was sinful. And so they're the most extreme sort of subset within Puritanism. What separates, I think, the Pilgrims and the Puritans later is I actually think the Pilgrims did a better job of distinguishing between the community that they were creating and the possibility of a future kind of civil state. The Pilgrims, one of the things I think we can so easily lose sight of is just the significance of the name. The name Pilgrim is something that William Bradford applied to them. Hmm. And he used that term because he said that he believed their mindset, very self-consciously, believed that the world was not their home, that they were sojourners and strangers, that their citizenship was in heaven. The Puritans are more likely, it seems to me, in the Massachusetts Bay Colony, the non-separatists, to eventually imagine a way of life in which the church and the state are in many ways fused. And they, in particular, begin to make comparisons of themselves to the children of Israel being sent by God to the promised land. And so just as God drives out the pagan peoples from the land of Canaan to create a place for his chosen, they are often speaking about the Native American, the indigenous people, as these pagans that God will clear out of the way for his chosen people. And that's a language that the Pilgrims just didn't use very much.
Interesting. Okay.
Which I think is a significant difference.
Yeah, fascinating. Let's talk about how do we appropriate this memory of the first Thanksgiving in the way we should think of ourselves as Christians in the United States today and as mm-hmm. those who are going to celebrate Thanksgiving
yeah.
today?
I think that's a great question. It's maybe the most important one.
And we've got about 2 minutes to do it, too.
All right. Here's a real quick answer. I would just underscore that the Pilgrims actually didn't believe in practicing a prescribed annual Thanksgiving. They actually argued that Thanksgiving celebrations were to be in response to the providential, extraordinary provision of God. And so what they did that we wouldn't do today is they would sometimes have multiple Thanksgivings in a year. Sometimes years would go by, they would have none. But what they were doing, I think, is that they were training themselves and training their children to look with expectancy daily for God's extraordinary provision in time of particular need. And one of the things that I just so admire that, and I've thought many times if I had learned this earlier when my children were very small, I would have loved to occasionally just surprise my family, not on the fourth Thursday in November, but just at some other moment. To say, wow, look at God's great kindness to us.
Yeah.
Let's celebrate. And that's really what the Pilgrims were doing, and we lose sight of that.
So they lived lives of expectation then, that God
Absolutely.
Was active in their
Absolutely.
Lives.
Absolutely. Yeah. And when you realize that of 102 passengers on the Mayflower, 52 had died when they had that celebration, that is just an amazing testimony to resilience and to a hope
yeah.
that was not grounded in the immediacy of their trial.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's one very clear thing, is to remember that rather than the ritualistic annual celebration of Thanksgiving, we should incorporate this expectation of God's intervention in our lives, his providential, his provision for us, and declare mm-hmm. days of Thanksgiving. Give me another one.
let's see. Well, one of the things that I would just encourage your listeners to is just to spend a little time with the Pilgrims themselves.
Yeah.
Because we have remade the Pilgrims every generation in our own image. So they have always sort of had the values that we thought were important at the time. But you go back and read some of William Bradford's History of Plymouth Plantation, for example, I think it exposes the way in which even devout Christians today have in many ways been shaped by our culture. We're a culture that favors autonomy above everything else. Mm-hmm. They talked in terms of obedience.
Yeah.
We think in terms of individualism. They thought in terms of order. Their worldview is just so foreign to ours.
Yeah.
And when we take them seriously and accept them as our brothers and sisters in Christ, they have something to say to us.
Yeah.
That we should hear.
Very good. Well, Dr. McKenzie, thanks so much for being with me today and for the first Thanksgiving, what the real story tells us about loving God and learning from history. Great talking with you.
My pleasure, Al. Thank you so much.
Again, Dr. Robert Tracy McKenzie, the book is available in the online bookstore, The First Thanksgiving, what the real story tells us about loving God and learning from history.
People ask how they can care for older family members who can't fully care for themselves. One answer is Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care. Visiting Angels assists adults nationwide with 600 locations to continue living at home and not have to move into a nursing home. Their caregivers provide assistance in hygiene, meals, and light housework. Services are provided up to 24 hours per day, and you can select your caregiver before service begins. More information, including franchise opportunities, is on the web at visitingangels.com.
This program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit St. Paul Street Evangelization. St. John Paul II stated that for the disciple of Christ, evangelization is a duty, an obligation of love, and the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that evangelization is necessary for salvation. So we know we're called, but how do we do it? St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. To learn more, contact us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Hi, I'm Al Cresta. Over the last 50 years, we've had some of the greatest popes since the Reformation era. So why are things such a mess in American Catholicism? How do we analyze and confront the attacks we're facing? How do we identify wolves in sheep's clothing? How do we re-evangelize the baptized? Dr. Ralph Martin makes sense of a church in crisis and shows pathways forward. He'll make sense of a disordered world. Go to AveMariaRadio.net and you'll find it in our online bookstore.
Religious freedom and healthcare and the right to life are under the greatest attack in American history. Right now, Catholic healthcare and the pro-life movement hang in the balance. My name is Lewis Brown, Executive Director of the Christ Medicus Foundation, and we are leading a new movement to defend religious freedom and civil rights in healthcare and to build the culture of life. We need your help now more than ever. Join this movement. Go to religiousfreedomandhealthcare.org. That's religiousfreedomandhealthcare.org.
Well, thanks so much for being with me over the last 2 hours. I hope this was an assistance in your Thanksgiving day and helped to, again, aid and abet a happy Thanksgiving. The books that we mentioned on this program, of course, always available in the online bookstore. Thanksgiving, The Holiday at the Heart of the American Experience by Melanie Kirkpatrick. And also What Thanksgiving Tells Us About Loving God and Learning from History by Dr. Robert Tracy McKenzie. We'll have that available there. And, of course, in the Cresta Guest Archives, you can follow Dr. Gregory Popchak's list of the benefits of gratitude. We'll have those posted there for you as well. Again, many psychological benefits to gratitude. Stay tuned now as we turn over the microphone to Catholic Answers Live, and I'll be back with you tomorrow. I'll see you then.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. To follow up on any of the guests or information presented on today's program, visit the Cresta Guest Archive at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMaria Radio.net. To listen to this or any other edition of Cresta in the Afternoon, visit the audio archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Or to order a CD of the program, call 734-930-4506 or email orders at AveMariaRadio.net. That's 734-930-4506 or orders at AveMariaRadio.net.